Today's episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by Shudder. Brought to you by AMC Networks, Shudder is not only a premium streaming video service, but an experience unlike any other. Created for fans of all degrees of thriller, suspense, and horror, Shudder is home to the largest and fastest-growing human-curated selection of high-quality, spine-tingling, and provocative films, TV series, and originals. And there's always something new and unexpected for Shudder members to explore.
New this week on Shudder is Found Footage 3D. A group of filmmakers sets out to make the first 3D found footage horror movie, but find themselves in a found footage horror movie when the evil entity from their final escapes into their behind-the-scenes footage. In the tradition of Scream and Behind the Mask, Found Footage 3D is an incredibly fun, clever horror film about the making of a fictional 3D found footage horror film. Energized and ever commenting on the genre, the film is a swift, surprising and clever, and most importantly, scary horror comedy fans. This is your new favorite movie. Stream the 2D version now with the 3D version starting October 26. Go to Rob's house for that, exclusively on Shudder.
Shudder is available for $4.99 a month or $49.99 with an annual membership, but our listeners can get a free month by entering the promo code SHOCK at checkout. Go to Shudder.com today and find the best collection of thrillers, suspense, and horror available to stream anywhere.
This episode is also brought to you by Fright Rags. This week, by the time this episode hits, Fright Rags will have all new apparel from John Carpenter's Halloween. Include shirts, socks, and pins. Will I have bought them all? Absolutely. As you know, Fright Rags this year has now, they now have custom-made orange and black baseball tees available with classic Halloween designs and vintage-styled Halloween decoration theme designs featuring Michael Myers and Sam for Trick or Treat. I actually have one that is Michael Myers holding a pumpkin.
Nice.
The black and orange baseball tee actually looks pretty damn good.
Love those baseball tees.
Also, if you go to FrightRags.com, Fright-Rags.com, there's exclusive General Mills Serial Monsters designs, and there's a new batch coming October 25th, which is rad. Yeah, I know.
We're excited about this.
Exclusive Jigsaw shirts and pins coming Friday, October 27th. Every order during the month of October will contain faux Fright Rags membership cards that are designed to look like a Blockbuster membership card. I actually have one sitting in my wallet.
Nice.
They have a special secret code on the back that is good for 10 to 50% off. So you never know what you're going to get when you get one of these membership cards.
Yeah, that's cool.
The amount will be revealed when the customer enters the code. I should do this live on the air and find out what my code is.
What your discount is.
Anyways, that's fright-rags.com.
Okay, and welcome to episode number 70 of Shockwaves. I'm one of your hosts, Rob Galuzzo. Sitting with me is Mr. Elric Kane.
It has been too long, Rob.
Has it?
A few hours.
I see you now.
It was a few hours ago that I saw you.
I guessed it on Elric's other podcast. Is that a spoiler?
That's a good time to tell. We'll be picking your horror brain for soundtracks.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it was fun. I like that Brian guy. I don't know about you, though.
Yeah,
you made it difficult.
Yeah. He carries us.
Yeah. Also with us, Mr. Ryan Turek.
Hello.
Welcome, man. Not with us is Rebecca McKendry, who unfortunately
had a medical emergency
on the way here before she came here.
We had to do the EpiPen thing to her. Finally, me and Rob got our chance to stab her in the heart like
several times.
No, you didn't.
Listen, don't ruin our dreams. There's always hope that we'll get to do that at some point.
Man, imagine if we really had to. That'd probably be freaky shit. I don't think I could. We'd just watch her die. I'm sure.
Volumes of things to be said about the fact that three co-hosts want to stab their fourth co-host.
It's a lot of love, man.
We just want to save her, Ryan.
Let me stab you to keep you alive.
Yeah, well, it's stabbing in the leg. Remember that. It's the leg.
Not the heart.
I'm doing the heart, not whatever the happens.
Well, listen, we've still got a great show for you regardless.
We're halfway through October.
Unbelievable.
God.
Unbelievable. But let me tell you, there's some fun stuff to talk about at the top of the show. This is something I've been keeping close to the vest.
And I just want to say congrats.
Oh. Which one?
Well, let's leave with you, Rob. This is important news. I know you've been kind of holding on to something else, but congrats on your new job.
Thank you very much. Nice. I'm the director of distribution for Epic Pictures, and I'm heading up their brand new all-genre label, Dread Central Presents. Uh-huh. Basically, Epic Pictures, they did, you know, Tales of Halloween, Turbo Kid. They did a lot of cool little features. Tales of... What's
Tail? The one, isn't it T-H-A-L-E?
Oh, yeah, that's correct. Yeah. Killer Mermaid, if you want to go deep. Yeah. Basically, they bought a piece of Dread Central last year, and so now it's one of their entities, and they decided that from here on out, whatever horror titles they put out, why not use that that label and make it Dread Central Presents? And so, they brought me on board, and I know a lot of people from Epic, I know a lot of people from Dread Central, and it just seemed like a really great opportunity to... On a grander scale, do what I did back in New York with my friends, because my friends were not movie savvy. I'd be the one that would find the weird movie and make them all sit through it and be like, here, watch this. Mm. And then they're like, oh, that was cool. And so now I kind of get to do that on a grander scale. I get to acquire movies and get to put them out.
That's
and,
awesome.
They're going to be, it's going to be mixed, and it's going to be all kinds of, subgenres of horror. We're going to try to cater to everybody. So
Sweet. We'll
see how that goes.
Well, we're proud of you, and it was nice to see your face on Deadline.com.
I was pretty shocked by that, but it was pretty cool. It definitely was cool. So that was number one.
Okay.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
No problem.
Number two.
Man, a laundry list of thanks coming here. Let's do it.
As of right now, Friday, okay. It is up right now. Hulu. I hope you guys are Hulu subscribers, because if you are, you can search Frights and Insights. I think they've got a section for Halloween. Hulu-ween, that's how it's pronounced. Basically, they had contacted me about producing some original content for Halloween, because they've got a whole slew of really cool movies. And so right now, the first three segments are up, which is pretty much me interviewing different people about their movies. They're like 5 minutes long each, but there's one with me and Tom Holland talking about Fright Night. There's a second segment, which is really cool. It's a John Dies at the End reunion. So it's me, Don Coscarelli, Rob Mays, and Chase Williamson.
Nice.
And then the third feature is a Monster Squad reunion. So it's myself with Andre Gower, Ryan Lambert, and Ashley Bank. So those three are up right now on Hulu if you want to search them. And even cooler, one of the things I got to do here was I really wanted to see how Shockwaves would translate to a video show. And so on Wednesday, October 25th, you can see a 20-minute version of Shockwaves as a Hulu original video. And so thank you guys for being willing to do it. I think it came out great.
I think it turned out great as well.
Will that be searchable through Shockwaves, or it'll still have to be searched as the...
You know what? I don't know how Hulu search works.
Yeah. I think you'll be able to type in Frights and Insights.
I think you could type in Frights and Insights.
Or Shockwaves.
You could type in Shockwaves. The other thing I was told, and I'm not sure how accurate this is, but I'm under the understanding that at 3 points you will see in their main banner. Mm. I believe on Friday when this goes live, you'll see the Monster Squad in their main banner on their main page.
Yeah.
Their carousel. Sunday will be Tom Holland and Fright Night. And then I believe you'll see little Shockwaves on that.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah. So I hope that's all accurate information.
And can you rate on Hulu?
I hope so. And
rate
listen,
us really well, guys.
I'd say Shocker
it.
Army. This is a chance to like tweet at Hulu once you watch it, if you like it.
Yes.
Only if you like it, don't do it just for the sake, because maybe that could be more if people demand it.
That'd be great.
That would be fun for us.
It would be a lot of fun. So yeah, check it out and please spread the word about it, because to me it's kind of, you know, we've always wanted to evolve the show in different ways, and this is kind of us putting our toe in the water, seeing if people would be interested in this sort of thing. So thank you to Hulu. Let's see, what else? The only other thing I wanted to plug before we get into what we've been watching and stuff is a podcast. Last year, there was a really cool podcast on Wondery called Inside Psycho, which is like a 6-part series narrative telling about, you know, kind of the making of Psycho. Mark Ramsey, who hosts it, has just unveiled a 7-part series called Inside the Exorcist.
Ooh.
They're up to episode 3 as of right now, And it is excellent. Mm. I think it's even better than the Inside Psycho one. It's a lot, you know, he kind of hosts it, but what's fun about it is it's a lot more narrative, but in a weird, you know, it's actually like fully produced. So there's like sound effects and all sorts of stuff happening. But like the first episode, for example, keeps cutting back and forth between the real case that inspired it from the 40s, a guy named, this kid named Robbie who is possessed.
Right.
A young William Peter Blatty hearing about the story for the first time. Mm. A young William Friedkin, you know, getting his first directing gig and meeting with Alfred Hitchcock. It's like all these great stories, like this whole narrative of how they all eventually intertwine.
What's it called?
It's called Inside the Exorcist, and you could find it on any podcast app. It's up to episode 3 of 7 right now.
Ooh.
And how often do they come out? Monthly or?
You know what? I honestly just caught up and there were 3 already there. So I think it's weekly, which is what Inside Psycho was. But sweet. That's the one.
Cool.
It's really cool. And I think you guys, and of course,
subscribe,
I mean, everyone's been watching this show. So I think this is like the perfect timing for this podcast as well. So
very cool.
Check that out.
In that kind of other medium kind of way, you talking about a podcast, I just want to I finished up Adam Rockoff's The Horror of It All book. He did Going to Pieces, The Rise and Fall of the Slasher Film. You know, Rockoff had sent me the book a while ago, and I had started it, but the rhythm of it kind of took me off guard for a second because I was like, okay, it's just okay, I'm going to be completely honest. I kind of wanted to write a book like this, which was just basically growing up as a horror fan, you know, and kind of what your initial attraction to it was, and then kind of maybe seminal points in your life that kind of shaped where you were today.
Right.
And once I got beyond that first chapter, I realized what he was kind of doing with it. And it's a lot of fun. It was a lot more engaging than I thought it would be. There was like one chapter that's just lists. There's another chapter that is basically him breaking down the Siskel and Ebert episode in which they attack horror. And then what he would do is he would find their talking points, have a counter argument for it, but then go into the history of the examples he was pulling into his counter argument, you know, talking about, you know, how most horror movies, you know, are all about, you know, killing women. And he's like, well, counterpoint to that is actually, you know, after statistically shown, it's actually more men that get killed in horror movies. And it just edges women out by like 3%. But it was just like, it was this that kind of attention to detail while paired with a personal journey that I really, really enjoyed.
So Adam's own personal story.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, it was cool. It was cool. So I would definitely check it out. I don't know if it got enough love when it first came out. It's called The Horror of It All.
Yeah, looking at the cover now. Cool.
Yeah, very cool. All right. So what have we guys seen? Let's jump right in.
I think it'd be easier to do What Haven't We Seen This Halloween. That'd be a shorter episode.
I'm still doing one a night, so.
I'll start with a couple. Two films with the letter T. Torture Garden, which I know is coming up on your anthology list.
I know, a few days away.
I hadn't seen this one. We were deciding it was on a triple feature on a Screen Factory with Brotherhood of Satan and something else.
Not Screen Factory, but somebody put it out.
Yeah. And oh man, it's really boring. And I hate that because look, the wraparound is actually really good. The wraparound is the best part of it, but each individual story is just kind of flat. It's Freddie Francis, who I really like as a DP, especially shot Elephant Man for Lynch and things like that. It's set up a carnival, a sideshow kind of thing. And the guy coming to the, you know, the haunted attraction, and that setup's a lot of fun. But man, I don't know. I'll table this conversation until you've seen it.
Okay, you want to talk about it together?
Touch base on it a little bit. But I just felt like this one was a little dry. I mean, it's Amicus. These are hit and miss. That's the great thing about anthologies. But the other T letter film, which I really expected not to like, because it did not look like my bag at all. In the same way that I wouldn't have necessarily thought I would have liked Happy Death Day as much as I did, is even though that had a great trailer, Tragedy Girls. A lot of fun.
I love Tragedy Girls.
It was so much fun. And I got to say, I think it's like this year's Final Girls. Yeah. Just in terms of, it hasn't got the same kind of heart that movie has, but it's actually probably a better film overall, maybe from start to end. I think Final Girls has such great heart to the backstory and the mom story, but maybe for me the horror parts were never as good, whereas this actually delivers on those elements.
It delivers on the horror elements, even if I felt the relationship between these two girls in the film is so cold and
so
cynical and
but so
ridiculous.
Modern. So modern.
Very
and so,
modern. You know. Yeah. I think my tendencies would lean more towards the mother-daughter relationship of Final Girls.
I agree with that part.
But again, I think I like the hyper-stylized witty banter slash relationship of, you know, of this film a lot.
And it does feel like most films that try to like be satirical of like modern technology and relationships tend to just do it and not actually be that satirical and just be kind of boring.
Yeah.
This actually does get to the heart of like social media and trends.
Oh, yeah.
And kind of reminds me of that episode of Black Mirror where the girl is rating everything.
Mm-hmm.
She does. It's a really smart film for a film that's about kind of dumb social characters.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, like just to get, just to lend a little context for the listeners, you know, the film is basically about these two girls who are very, who are murderous. And what they're doing is they're killing people in their town and basically acting like they're also the like investigators of the murders that are happening.
They're bloggers.
They're bloggers who are trying to get to the root of these murders while using their social media to get clout.
Yeah.
But they're the ones who are doing all the killing.
And they're obsessed by, you know, serial killers and stuff. So at the start, their local town's Jason, they've basically captured that person and keep killing in front of him. He's like, what the fuck's wrong with you? And it's a lot of fun. And it's maybe has a little bit of Leslie Vernon in there too, I'd say. Like a little bit of that.
Yeah.
Like,
oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
But this one definitely took me because it's on paper, it is not my kind of movie. And right. I thought it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was a good time. Look, that must be coming out, I think, this weekend.
I think it's playing theatrically.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's one that I think Ryan and I saw that I'm actually really curious to talk about. Are you ready to get into this?
Let's do it.
Yeah, a Netflix original called The Babysitter, directed by Mick G. Right there, strike
it.
One.
Written by Brian Duffield.
Okay.
That's a plus one.
All right. Evening out a little bit.
Starring Samara Weaving, another plus one.
Yes, Bella Thorne. Right? She's in the
movie. Bella Thorne.
I got the
that's
right
a
one.
Half grade.
That's
down.
A point down.
Our episode just got retweeted 2 million times just from that one mention. Well done, Rob.
There you go.
Well,
yeah, yeah.
No. I actually like Bella.
So, tell me what you thought.
My history of The Babysitter is a little weird because it was like the second script I had actually read when I came in here to Blumhouse. It was Brian Duffield. It was a writer who I was not aware of at the time. But I sat there one night and just kind of jumped into what I had presumed was going to be a kind of an R.L. Stein-esque thriller. And then I was absolutely struck by the humor of the script. I really, really loved it. And if you guys don't know the plot, it's basically about a young boy who's got a hot babysitter that comes over to take care of him for the weekend. And on the first night that he is over, before she has some friends over, she's like, hey, you want to do a shot? And he's like, yeah, sure, why not? Like, this is how cool The Babysitter is.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, you know what? I'm kind of into this. This babysitter is cool. And then that night, what she's actually preparing him for is a satanic ritual in which she's going to sacrifice him.
Oh, great.
And so she's got her friends over to help perform the task. And as I was going through the script, what was great is that there's one page that just says, what the fuck?
When
you get to it, once the reveal happens. And then onward, it's just a gory display of this young boy versus the babysitter and all her friends.
Uh-huh.
I wanted it so bad. Yeah. I really wanted to do it, but there were, I think McG was already involved or somebody there was already a studio that was involved, but I think they were looking for partners or something. I don't know what complicated it, but we couldn't do it. And then it was made over at Warner Brothers New Line and then they sold it to Netflix. They put it out last week
on Friday. 13th,
on Friday 13th, we watched it and, you know, goddamn McGee. I'm not the biggest fan of his, but I felt like this was the most tolerable movie he's ever made. I kind of just saw through his bullshit and paid attention to just the fun tone. This is really over the top, really gory, at times incredibly funny. And there's just like a lot of off color stuff and whatnot and whatever. But, I just had a blast with it, you know, and my girlfriend watched it with me and, you know, she kind of rolled with it. And at halfway through, she was like,
fiance,
continue. Sorry. Thanks, Ellie.
She pays me big dollars for that.
She, you know, halfway through, she turned to me and she was like, this is better than I expected. And I was like, well, yeah, the script is fun, but you know, it's McG.
Yeah.
Like, there's just a little bit of McG, like,
that's
tarnish.
Interesting. I'll be honest with you. So this was something that kept getting a lot of attention, like, right before. But everyone was saying, don't watch the trailer. The trailer gives away too much. So I was like, all right, well, do you know, brand new Netflix movie? Sounds cool. I started watching it, and I can't explain it, but I initially just could not connect. And I was like hating this movie so much. Yeah. And I don't know if it's like, look, Michi created Chuck. So like his quirky sensibility works for the show Chuck. Yeah. But like, I guess it was because you ever see something that's like just too quirky for its own good? Mm-hmm. Like, all right, they're introducing all the characters and their names are coming up on the screen. And it's like, I've seen that from Robert Regan's The Faculty all the way through to
Napoleon Dynamite.
It's a detention. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like, well, it's not really, I'm kind of tired of this. Yeah. But that said, because I was having a lot of trouble getting through, and I don't know why, I just didn't like the characters or whatever. But everyone kept talking about it so positively, including Ryan. Yeah. And so I actually like commented, I was like, I guess I have to finish this stupid thing. So I plowed through, and much to my surprise, once everything kicked in, like once the actual, that main plot point, maybe 35, 40 minutes in, the movie really won me over by the second half. And in fact, the conclusion, like the last, you know, I don't want to give anything away, but obviously the finale, there's so much heart to it that it, like the heart shines through in McGee's fucking gimmicks and it ends up being actually really good. So not normally what I would like, even though that's the irony. I love horror comedy. Yeah. And for some reason, this wasn't connecting to me, I guess because I thought they were just trying too hard, and yet it totally worked. It won me over.
I completely agree with you. You know, say what you will about McGee, but yes, there is that feeling that he is trying way too hard to like really, he doesn't let the characters just be. He doesn't, you know, I mean, like they wind up shining through the style. Samara Weaving in this movie is fantastic. You know, you guys might remember her from Ash vs. Evil Dead. She's in Joe's movie, Mayhem. And
I thought she was Bella Thorne. I had no idea. She's really good.
She's really good. Bella Thorne is the cheerleader.
Oh, that makes sense. Okay.
But, there's just some really funny stuff. You know, there's, I don't know, it's not going to give anything away, but there's a moment where the kid's tied up and he's like trying to, he's got a little pocket knife and he's like got his hands behind a chair and he's like chiseling away and all of the villains are standing in front of him and he's like trying to buy him time to cut the rope. And they're like, we see what you're doing. And he's like, what? And he's like, there's a mirror right behind you. And then they're like, look, you keep doing it. You're still doing it. And he's like, well, yeah.
I got to try.
That's
funny.
So yeah, there's quirky things like that I really like.
Well, here's the thing. You know, if you guys are new listeners, you know, my tastes run towards this kind of shit. You know, I love crazy teen horror comedy sometimes. Like Detention, Lawrence Raffel.
Detention's great fun.
You know, call me his little sister for the longest time because I love Detention. I was like, dude, come on. And I can hear the ghost of Lawrence Raffel going, little sister Turek likes the babysitter. Lawrence, I love you if you're listening. No, I just kind of love this stuff. And if it's done well and introduces some new elements, then I'm game. And this was just like so gory. It's so much
fun. Yeah, it is over the top gory.
And I would probably lose my mind if I was in high school reading Fangoria and reading Guinness.
Right.
Oh my God. I'd be over the moon.
Good poster. Makes me
awesome. Yeah, composer.
No, it was very
good. Soundtrack. Right.
You sold me. I'll watch it for next week.
Continue, Elric. I'm on my anthology kick, but I'm just going to fly through those at the very end.
I've been going through my one a night. I did, since last week, I did Halloween 4 and Child's Play 2, The Babysitter, Going to Pieces. I watched a documentary for that, which debuted on Stars a couple years ago. Fright Night, of course, and last night I did Slither. Halloween 4 is a film that year after year I have a newfound appreciation for it. I was always kind of down on Halloween 4 growing up.
Yeah.
But it has a lot of atmosphere. Mm-hmm. It's pretty cool.
It feels like it's in the world still.
My favorite opening. Opening shots of that movie are like the coolest of the Halloween franchise.
Child's Play 2. You know what's funny? I love Child's Play 2. I actually kind of sometimes put it on par with the first one.
Wow.
I love the I love the look of the movie. I love how fucking mean-spirited he is.
It's mean.
And it's like kind of like the last movie where he is just pure. He's a pure asshole.
Yeah.
And then what they do to him at the end is fantastic, you know? And then The Babysitter we talked about, Going to Pieces. So this documentary came out in 2006, 2007.
Yeah, it's great.
It's very good. Really rough around the edges, but they got some great content from a lot of great people. But oh my God, the soundtrack is so bad to a point where it's almost, it almost distracts you from what's going on. I don't know who did the soundtrack for it. I meant to look when I was checking out the credits, but it is aggressive and it is loud. There's just like one theme that they keep pounding into your brain over and over.
Maybe they didn't get, who knows?
I don't know.
I remember liking it. I haven't seen it in years.
And yeah, it's really well done. And stylistically, they try to mix it up a little bit from the usual talking heads. They got everybody to like kind of do walk and talks through really interesting environments.
Harry Manfredini.
Harry?
Harry.
He did the score?
Come on.
Jesus.
You just gave him.
They paid him for like, they paid him for two themes.
He's pretty notorious for that. As we just forked over money for yet another Friday 13th soundtrack on vinyl this week.
Exactly. Oh, yeah, totally. And then I'll wrap on Slither. We watched Slither last night.
I've been meaning to revisit that because I haven't seen it since it came out.
The New Blue. Yep. And I still really enjoy it. It's good to see James Gunn pre-Guardians of the Galaxy still cutting loose with some really, really crazy jokes. And, you know, like jokes that he would never get away with in the Marvel Universe.
Yeah.
But what I found, guys, I'll tell you something. This is the third time I've shown Slither to a woman in my life. And it does not work.
Oh, man. Yeah.
Holy shit. Wow. Like it is repellent. And I'm sure there are a lot of listeners out there that go, no, you're wrong. But and that's great. But the women of my life, at least, I took a first date to Slither.
I remember that story.
That was just terrible. Then I showed someone else and she was just like, this is disgusting. I don't understand this movie. Ciara rolled with it once I said, it's a horror comedy.
Yeah.
And then she was like, ah, got it. All right. Because in the first 5 minutes, I was like, no one acts like this.
Yeah.
And then there was also, ooh, Nathan Fillion.
Is it a Rooker problem?
You know what? I think, yeah, it could be a Rooker problem.
Oh, come on,
could
Rooker?
I love the Rooker, but also, I know some people have that problem.
The invasiveness of the aliens and the kind of the kind of unpleasant attack Rooker has on that one woman with his tentacles.
All right,
it borders on so many different unpleasant
things.
We
need to hear from our female listeners. Yeah. Do any of you like Slither? We need to know.
You know, we should just do a poll on Twitter.
Yeah.
And if not, just tweet at us, Rooker problem. That's what we want. Hashtag Rooker problem. We'll probably actually hear from him.
All righty. What about you, Elric? Anything else?
Yeah, man. I saw a couple other things. You know what? I finally been waiting to rewatch Stendhal Syndrome for a while now. This is lame because I should have watched the new fancy Blu-ray, but I just watched it on Amazon. It still looked great to me, but I've always said to people that in my opinion, this was his last good movie. His last masterpiece is definitely opera, but I really liked it. I gotta say, I really enjoyed watching it. It's a fucked up movie. It is dark. It is incredibly rapey and intense, and especially when you think luckily that's the point of it. It's not just rapey from a point of view. The main character is a serial rapist and he's an awful, awful, Thomas Kretschmann plays a very scary guy. I remember always being pretty put off by him when I started pretty young.
Yeah.
Watching it now makes a lot more sense. But they have a couple of these shots where they showed like him shooting a woman in the mouth and it watches the bullet go in close up, slow motion. It's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
Kind of photography. What's cool about this movie is I feel like this is one of the last times where it feels like Dario was still swinging for the fences, trying to make, because to me, this almost felt watching it this time, like, oh, this is his Marnie. I mean, it's not that much like Marnie, but it felt like he was trying to make his crazy, weird, you know, stuff about a woman and her sexuality. And at the end, she's wearing a crazy Hitchcock blonde wig for the last act of this movie, which is totally bizarre. The first half an hour is really solid, really intense. Then the middle part kind of just meanders to this really strange place. And then in the last act goes into a totally different type of movie.
It feels like a different movie.
It really is like a different movie.
Like two movies.
But I still found it really engaging. I thought the stuff with the art's really interesting. You know, it's just a strange movie, but I still think it's a really interesting one. So if you're, and it was fun because I really felt like a lot of it I didn't remember. You know, I remembered the feeling of it, but it was fun to watch. I'm running out of those ones. I think I want to do Sleepless. I've only seen Sleepless once.
Yeah.
And I bet if I watch it now, I'll be like, oh, yeah, interesting. But pretty solid. I'm kind of shocked they made a 3-disc. for something like that? I don't know.
I mean, Blue Underground and Bill Lustig were talking about
it. I don't know what you put on those other discs, but I appreciate it. Don't get me wrong. I thought it was pretty cool.
There's a new Asia interview, actually.
Oh, cool.
And I've
always loved her from the very start, and I think it's really interesting, you know, her leading the charge in this Weinstein stuff, her and Rose McGowan. So, you know, totally team Asia. Mindhunter, I'm 8 of 10 episodes into the TV show. It starts a little slow for a lot of people, I'm going to guess, but it's literally Zodiac meets Mad Men, exactly to a T. Like, you don't need to know anything else about it. It's slow moving, but it's like, it takes its time. It's very interesting. I mean, this is a true story. Mindhunter, the book, which was a true crime story written by the guy who basically came up with the concept of profiling for the FBI. He wrote a book about all his dealings with all these different people and how they came up with how to profile and how to, you know, basically this idea of charting serial killers. It's not a narrative at all. So this book that it's based on, it didn't have like a story of like, hey, then I was hanging out with the guy. It's not like the show. But when I read that, I was like 20 in college, and I think I might have told you this before, but I literally enrolled in criminology and did a whole degree in this based on that and body parts, which I've told before. I love that movie so much. I thought I wanted to be a criminal. So for me, this was kind of exciting to get to see what this, and it's Fincher. So it's like, it still looks like a David Fincher movie. It just moves a little slow, I think, for some audience.
How many episodes?
I think there's 10. So I'm on 8. I've got 2 more to go. It's not really a binge show. I kind of did, but I feel like it's the kind of thing you could totally just watch like 2 at a time. Mm-hmm. But good stuff. Good stuff there. And then was at Screamfest for 2 films.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
One you took me to.
Yes.
Which we'll talk about in a sec. And the first one was by a friend of mine who I've worked with and a longtime listener of our show, Preston DeFrancis, made a film called Ruin Me. He had told me about it a few years ago. So it's always cool when a friend, I mean, of course, I'm going to be biased, but when somebody tells you about just an idea and then years later you see it on a screen, there's something you're always pretty proud of. And luckily, I didn't know too much about the story, just the basic concept. The concept was a couple are going, and one's not a horror person, but the boyfriend is. They're going to go on a weekend retreat to the kind of thing that Ryan often talks about going on. It's like a full weekend of immersive horror entertainment. It's the scariest thing you can do. And you meet a couple other weirdos on the thing who are all kind of doing the same immersive weekend that just happens to be like a camping, very Friday 13th based, which is funny because Preston, I will honestly say, Preston is probably the biggest Friday 13th fan I've met. And what's funny, he even designed a Friday 13th card game at one point. I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say that, but you know, that almost like actually happened and stuff. So I think he made this feature instead of that going. I don't want to spoil it, Preston. You can sue me if I'm out of turn, but he really genuinely loves this stuff. So, and the film kind of almost has a little bit of that vibe, but it's black comedy. The first act was, I feel like, was less tailored for me, and I think a lot of people will like that about it. It's like more kind of, you know, satirical comedy of horror. But then right in the middle of the movie, it takes a complete turn. I'm not going to ruin it, of course. Mm. And then I was fully engaged for the rest of it because it was really about something.
Yeah.
So it was a really cool to see a movie that started, and that's made for, you know, it looks like, he's shooting on a shoestring, I'm sure, to pull this off, but they really put everything on the screen. And I think this will be a cool one. And I know it doesn't have distro yet. So it's always like, you know, when it's somebody, you know, festival, it's doing a good festival run. It's playing at almost every festival. So look out for it. If it plays near you, congrats, Preston, and thank you for listening to Shockwaves, because I know he's a long-time listener. And then the other one, which you took me to, which is a totally different movie. These two movies couldn't be more different, because this is a lot more lush and a period piece and, like, bigger budget, I would assume, called The Lodgers.
Yeah.
And you had already seen this film, but you took a few of us to go check it out, which was really exciting.
Yeah, it was made by Epic Pictures, who I work for now. It just seemed like this would be – I hadn't seen it on the big screen yet. I watched a screener on my laptop, and everybody knows how much I hate watching stuff on my computer.
Yeah.
And so getting the opportunity to see something like this on the big screen, I wanted to take advantage of, and I figured, let me bring a bunch of my friends so we can all enjoy it together. So, all right, be gentle.
It's a very elegant film. My only – and it's not a backhanded, because I grew up – in New Zealand, like when I was young, everything was BBC and everything's like a period piece and everyone's got the British and everyone's very polite. And just, I kind of grew up, that always bothered me. So my only negative was like after it ended, I was like, oh, it's a little too much BBC, not enough Jean Roland. And I was just meaning that because there's a lot of moments that actually do look very much almost like Jean Roland, which I thought was kind of exciting. But
right. And people should know it. It takes place in Ireland and it's a period piece that's in the 1920s. And it was directed by Brian O'Malley, who had done a film that really surprised all of us called Let Us Pray. Prey.
I had no idea.
Yeah, this is the director of Let Us Pray.
Which I loved. Let Us Pray.
Yeah, this is his follow-up to that.
Well, that makes a lot more sense because there are sequences in this movie that are on that level. So that makes a lot of sense to me now because I was thinking, oh, is this a first-time director? How is he pulling off these crazy sequences? Yeah, yeah. So this is a movie that I feel like has, you know, certain static qualities at the start, like the setup. But once you're into it, it really has some pretty amazing surreal, the kind of imagery like you knew I was going to like. You know, that's why you dragged me because it's like, you know, stuff you're going, how are they even doing this? There's stuff in the house. Basically, there's a big old haunted house. Everything in that is great in this movie. Like every scene that takes place there, every scene around it at the estate is fascinating. And it's got a, you know, it's got a pretty gross when you actually look at the story and think about what it's about. It's like pretty nasty and ugly, but it's done in an elegant way and is pulled off well. You know, I think
when Ryan saw it, he's like, oh, a whole lot of incest going on.
Yeah,
in that
a lot
movie.
Of incest. A lot, and I feel like British films are always about incest. I think that's what
anyways,
they do.
I love the main girl who was played by Charlotte Vega.
She's excellent.
I thought she was, in particular, watching it this time, I just thought she stood out so much. And she's a Spanish actress that's been done a lot of Spanish TV. Yeah.
You would not. She seemed like the most British actress ever.
Right? That's weird. So I thought she made her debut in a tiny little part in Rec 3.
Oh, cool.
That's, you know.
But I think this film would, like, I feel like this will find an audience. I mean, it's somewhere between, if The Innkeepers didn't have comedy, The Innkeepers and Oz Perkins' last film, you know, I'm the Pretty Thing.
Yeah.
It has elements of those, but it's, you know, it feels like a bigger production. I think people are going to dig it. I'd say I like two-thirds of it I loved and thought was really impressive. And other parts I'm just like, okay, yeah, you know. Okay. But, you know, that's not bad.
Not bad at all. Two-thirds ain't bad these days.
It's an almost glowing endorsement.
Well, very cool. I mean, I just to wrap up, I've been maintaining my 31 horror anthologies, one per night. It's been really difficult. Now it's like almost – now I have so much sympathy for Brian Collins because it's like – you come home from work by like 10 o'clock or
the
whatever.
Last
you're
night,
like,
right,
oh my
probably,
God,
yeah.
I've got 2 hours left to make it into this day. Like it won't count if I, you know. So as long as I started before midnight, then I'm
you're
golden.
Good.
And so I revisit a lot that I've already seen. Cat's Eye is still a lot of fun. Yeah. I even enjoy the last segment.
Do you have a favorite segment now, like looking back on it?
Quitter's Inc. is pretty spectacular, the first one.
I just love the guy climbing.
But also now because James Wood is such a piece of shit, it's kind of fun to see him getting tortured.
But it's also just a bummer that he's turned out to be that way because I've always liked him in movies.
Yeah. He's just terrible. So it's kind of fun to see him get kind of tortured in that movie. But I do love the, I like the second one on the ledge.
Yeah,
and
I
like the last segment with the little troll thing. Yeah. There's something about it, I think, the nostalgic factor of how much I love that as a kid.
And also, seeing that as a kid would be totally different.
I just revisited last night's was Trilogy of Terror, which is still great.
That's great.
I actually had a Dan Curtis. Is it Dan Curtis?
Yeah.
I did a Dan Curtis double basically because I watched his Dead of Night the night before. I watched both versions of Dead of Night. I'd never seen the original. And it was really good, but I was delirious. So like only bits of it actually like soaked in. I'm going to have to rewatch it. But again, the newer one's okay. There's one, because I'd only seen the segment Bobby.
Yeah, that's the only segment that I really...
And that is terrific.
I think it's just one of the best segments ever.
One of the scariest things ever made, and it's still great. But I kind of liked some of the other stuff. I mean, the first segment...
The one with the car is kind of lame.
Well, yeah, and but I like it because it's Ed Begley Jr. Like, it's fine, but it's not really a scary tale.
Yeah, no.
It's just kind of... It's almost feels like that's an amazing story is within a Twilight Zone.
Is the other
movie.
One a Lance Henriksen car thing with the priest, or is that a
no?
Different
that you're thinking of Nightmares.
Yeah, that's a crazy.
That's a Nightmares
episode.
And they're all
like
starting
that.
To kind of get
yeah,
mixed up.
That's true.
No, the middle one was actually fun because it was kind of a Martin-esque sort of story, but not really. Where this older guy has got his wife apparently is having an affair with this guy, and so. Basically, he frames the guy into being a vampire or letting people think he's a vampire.
Weird, I don't remember.
So I was like, oh, that's kind of cool. So I thought that was good, but, you know, they don't hold the candle to Bobby, which is just
Bobby,
terrific.
You know what I mean? If somebody gave me $1 million right now, I'd say, like, maybe I'll just make a remake of Bobby as a whole film. Because I do think it could be a whole story. I mean, because what you don't get in Bobby, which is what's actually kind of cool about it, is how you just see this, like, housewife. You have no idea who she is. She just looks like a normal housewife. And then she starts drawing the pentagram on the floor, and you're like,
it's
what?
Wonderful.
So, I mean, that could be the first 20 minutes. Could be the losing Bobby
right,
in the
right.
movie, but it's got so much atmosphere.
So that's cool. I watched The Willies for the first time, and that was one that basically I've been mixing it up because I had a lot that I'd seen already, and I'm like, you know what, screw it. If I have access to new movies that I haven't seen yet, I'm going to sub them in. And so that one's pretty good. It's more of a slightly more, it's like a kid-friendly, like, you know, around the campfire sort of thing, but so many recognizable faces are in it. Like Sean Astin's one of the kids. Clu Gulager popped up in one segment along with... who's the other guy that's, that he's in Return of Living Dead with? James Caron?
Oh, yeah, they're both in it.
But the weird thing about that is it's a wraparound, and it's only actually two stories. And so the first one's pretty interesting, and it kind of connects to the second story. But the second story takes up, like, 50 minutes of it, and it gets kind of like, all right, I've kind of had enough of this.
That actually is a good question. What do you, when you say anthology in your brain, does that usually just say three? I usually do.
Yeah, no, that's the average.
But Creepshow's like three, four.
No, Creepshow's five.
Yeah, Creepshow's always been too many, even though it's great. It's
The only one that was, they did three for Creepshow two.
No, but it's funny how that word, even anthology, makes me think of three.
Yeah, like three stories. Yeah, because you figure half
hour. Two doesn't feel like,
two is a little too, you know, two in a wraparound.
Yeah, it's like an anthology.
But it was fun to check out. It was only like $6 on DVD anyway. So I'm continuing. I'm very excited. I think this week I'm going to check out Asylum, which is one of the Amicus ones that everyone loves.
I'm double thumbs up there.
And because of my connections, let's just say I'm going to get a look at the Blu-ray a little early. So that's the way I'm going to see it for the first time.
Has it been released?
Severin is putting it out. Severin Films. So
Severin's are starting to put out some. I mean, they've always put out good like indie like stuff, but now they're getting a little bigger.
They're
that's
up
like
in
a
their
big
game. And in fact, David Gregory will be on.
Oh, cool.
Again, to make a major announcement on one of their upcoming.
When will it become? We don't know.
We haven't worked it out yet, but it's going to be soon. So
yeah, he's always a fountain of information to talk to anyway. So it's always fun to talk to him.
All right, cool. Well, let's bring in our guest, and we'll continue this conversation.
And don't fall asleep. Hey.
Today's episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by Shudder. Brought to you by AMC Networks, Shudder is not only a premium streaming video service, but an experience unlike any other. Created for fans of all degrees of thriller, suspense, and horror, Shudder is home to the largest and fastest-growing human-curated selection of high-quality, spine-tingling, and provocative films, TV series, and originals. And there's always something new and unexpected for Shudder members to explore.
New this week on Shudder is Found Footage 3D. A group of filmmakers sets out to make the first 3D found footage horror movie, but find themselves in a found footage horror movie when the evil entity from their final escapes into their behind-the-scenes footage. In the tradition of Scream and Behind the Mask, Found Footage 3D is an incredibly fun, clever horror film about the making of a fictional 3D found footage horror film. Energized and ever commenting on the genre, the film is a swift, surprising, and clever, and most importantly, scary horror comedy fans. This is your new favorite movie. Stream the 2D version now with the 3D version starting October 26. Go to Rob's house for that, exclusively on Shudder.
Shudder is available for $4.99 a month or $49.99 with an annual membership, but our listeners can get a free month by entering the promo code SHOCK at checkout. Go to Shudder.com today and find the best collection of thrillers, suspense, and horror available to stream anywhere.
This episode is also brought to you by Fright Rags. This week, by the time this episode hits, Fright Rags will have all new apparel from John Carpenter's Halloween. Include shirts, socks, and pins. Will I have bought them all? Absolutely. As you know, Fright Rags this year has now, they now have custom-made orange and black baseball tees available with classic Halloween designs and vintage-styled Halloween decoration theme designs featuring Michael Myers and Sam for Trick or Treat. I actually have one that is Michael Myers holding a pumpkin.
Nice.
The black and orange baseball tee actually looks pretty damn good.
Love those baseball tees.
Also, if you go to FrightRags.com, Fright-Rags.com, there's exclusive General Mills Serial Monsters designs, and there's a new batch coming October 25th, which is rad. Yeah, I know.
I'm excited about this. Say it, Ryan.
Exclusive Jigsaw shirts and pins coming Friday, October 27th. Every order during the month of October will contain faux Fright Rags membership cards that are designed to look like the Blockbuster membership card. I actually have one sitting in my wallet.
Nice.
They have a special secret code on the back that is good for 10 to 50% off. So you never know what you're going to get when you get one of these membership cards.
That's cool.
The amount will be revealed when the customer enters the code. I should do this live on the air and find out what my code is.
What your discount is.
Anyways, that's fright-rags.com. Okay, Okay, I know that I ducked out for about 20 minutes, guys. Sorry about that. And no, I wasn't.
Nobody noticed, Brian.
I wasn't taking a work phone call. Well, it seems I have a reputation on Facebook where it's like, oh, Turek ducked out because he's so busy.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I love you guys. No, I was out running to the parking lot to go grab our guest. I've been walking around the hallways today, boasting that we have horror royalty coming in.
Yeah,
that's right.
And I was very, very excited. Please welcome Heather Langenkamp.
Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for
very
coming.
Very happy to be here.
We're not always this male dominant, just so you know. We,
we do have a girl, but she had an allergic reaction on the way here, unfortunately.
A likely story.
Yes, indeed. I need to jump in really quick and get this out of the way immediately, because I shared this story with Amanda Weiss, who obviously is Nightmare on Elm Street. So everyone that's listening to the show already knows this story, so I apologize for being repetitive. But Nightmare on Elm Street's my gateway into the horror world that forever changed me. I grew up on Universal Monster movies, but those didn't really scare me. And so I had older cousins that would taunt and torture me with stories of Freddy Krueger. And I didn't know what they were talking about. I was like 10 years old. And so they finally sat me down and said, this is it. We're going to make you watch this. And I loved it. It scared the crap out of me. I was so upset that they immediately followed it up with Better Off Dead to prove to me that Tina wasn't dead. They're like, Tina didn't die. She's breaking John Cusack's heart right here. It's all okay. And so inadvertently, my cousins don't realize this, but that day they kind of shaped me, because I grew up loving horror and 80s comedies.
And Amanda West, right?
And I told her that story, and she said that was the best story that she'd heard regarding, she's like, oh, wow, what a double bill.
The magic of movies.
Yeah, absolutely.
She killed her and resurrected her.
So I've always loved them, and it's just an honor to finally meet you and have you on the show.
Thank you. Well, it's funny because a lot of families did like show Nightmare on Elm Street to their younger siblings and younger cousins as like this rite of passage. And I always think, like, what else is there in American society where you like torture people?
Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, it was just good synergy, because I was recently on a production and I was in a hotel room and New Nightmare popped up on Netflix. They just recently added it. And I was like, I haven't seen New Nightmare in a long time. And so I sat down and I watched it, and I just loved the fact that Wes, as a director, the challenge is, I'm sure as Bob Shea would have said, was like, we need one more Nightmare on Elm Street. What can you do after Freddy's dead? What can you do after all these films? And Wes stepped up to the plate and said, I'm going to do something in which it takes place in the real world. And, you know, as I was watching the first 10 minutes, it dawned on me, because I haven't seen it in a long time, I was like, oh, wait, Heather is now in the makeup effects world. And in this film, she's married to makeup. And I was like, wait a second. So I started doing a little research deep dive, as you do late, you know, at night on the internet. And then Chris reached out to me and he's like, you should have Heather on the show. And I was like, perfect. This is like literally 2 days later. So
yeah. Weird. That's great.
No, it was really great. So that is actually what I'm most fascinated by, you know, because I mean, we've seen a lot of interviews, we've read a lot of interviews, but in talking to a lot of the staffers here at Blumhouse, who I told were coming in, your jump to the world of makeup effects is unknown to a lot of people, which is interesting. And I think it popped up for me when I was watching Cabin in the Woods. And I saw your name in the credits, and I was like, can't be that, Heather. Wait, and then I looked, and I was like, it is.
We're not going to ask her all the same.
Well, I want to
over and over again.
But I would love to where
I'm kidding.
All over, but you can go backwards. And I know, I'm just curious, is it like, when did you make that leap, and how did that leap happen?
Yeah.
Well, let me think about how it actually happened. It was actually not haphazard, but it was very practical. Yeah. So I did Nightmare 7 with Wes, and, you know, I had a kind of a stalkery problem, and I was pretty disillusioned with my career, actually very disillusioned with it. And, you know, Wes gave me a job at a time when I really was having a hard time getting work, and I already had a boy, and he was about 2.5, 3 years old, and just it was so hard to get work. And then I decided, I've got to change. Something's got to, where I feel like I have purpose and I have something to do. And so in the next couple of years, we went traveling a lot. My husband's a makeup effects and a makeup artist, and we went, you know, he worked for Charlie Sheen at the time. And so we went all over the world with Charlie, and I kind of got away from Hollywood, and still, you know, I told my agents, you know, call me if there's anything, but, you know, it was pretty quiet. And so when we got back from this like European adventure. We did, well, my husband worked on the Musketeers mm-hmm. with Charlie and The Arrival and all these movies that were in fun places. We came back and my husband said, you know, I'm going to just kind of start my own company. We're going to start working on a lot more makeup effects here in LA so I can stay home. And so I started little by little getting involved just as a bookkeeper, really just helping him with the books and making sure, you know, his secretary wasn't taking money and, you know, just checking up on what's going on, helping him in the day-to-day workings of the shop. And then he got Dawn of the Dead. And that really was kind of the time when I decided to really get involved in a bigger way. So we went up to Toronto and we took over an entire big, kind of like a drugstore, abandoned drugstore that was in a mall that they were actually using to shoot Dawn of the Dead with Zack Snyder. And we had to literally build tables. We had to, you know, make an office space. We had to buy computers. We had to do pretty much everything from the ground up. And we worked on, you know, getting all those zombie makeups made. And it was really fun. And I did never a day of makeup. I mean, people ask me if I'm a makeup artist. So basically what I did is just manage the entire operation and the company. You know, I have to go talk to the accountants when the budgets are getting whacked out tell them, like, we need a 300 people today. You know, we're going to be making up 300 zombies. We need, you know, this many staff. And so learning how to talk to the producers, learning how to kind of get what we want and compromise. And so they're not, you know, out of, you know, money by the end of the show. And it was a thrilling experience. I really enjoyed it. I found like I had a lot of talent, you know, helping my husband, making him feel comfortable so he could just create all that mayhem. And then when we came back to LA, I decided I'm just going to go to work for you. And so, I still, you know, would go on auditions and try to get parts, but by then I'd had my daughter and it was just really conducive to our family life that we would work and I wouldn't be going away and he wouldn't be going away to different places. So it kind of helped our family stay together, I felt, and we got better and better parts. I mean, we, you know, then did Cabin in the Woods. Mm-hmm. We've done Star Trek Into Darkness. We've been doing the last four seasons of American Horror Story. I mean, my husband is the total creative force. I am not at all the creative force. I always want to, you know, he's the one who does all the designs. Piggy Man, you guys probably know Piggy Man really well from Hollywood Horror Nights. Yeah. And I mean, the Universal.
Yeah.
Is it called Hollywood Horror Nights, though?
Halloween Horror Nights.
So
I will say that that is the one thing that made me jump at every turn.
It's Piggy Man.
Oh, it was ridiculous. Ridiculous.
I was hoping he was going to be a more like fleshed out character. Like he was there a lot, but, you know, and Twisty the Clown is David's creation with, you know, other folks who always collaborate with him. But so it's been a blast being, you know, the person who helps someone who is really creative, which is my husband, David Anderson, like get to just do his thing. And I love it. I mean, though I do miss, you know, acting. So that's why in the last, say, 4 or 5 years, I've been really trying to, like, try to get back in. And, you know, it's just tough, you know, being an older woman. It's just, it's hard, you know. But I don't mind the challenge. I just, you know, I just want to find parts that are good. Because once you've played Nancy Thompson, it's like a lot of parts like, oh, really? I have auditioned for things like, you know, technician number 4. And I'm like, nah, I don't want to do that.
Yeah. How has the landscape changed in terms of acting or just the business of
I feel kind of left behind. I mean, I see how, you know, it's all internet based and there's so many opportunities for actors all over the world now to audition for parts. I mean, you can send your audition in from New Zealand or, you know, wherever, and, you know, and you're going to have the same kind of eyes on you as if, in the olden days, you just had to be in LA. You had to be in Hollywood. And so I feel like I have to kind of get more hip to that entire new structure.
Yeah.
But I just enjoy, you know, I go to a lot of conventions. I have my little cottage industry of Nightmare on Elm Street that I'm constantly like nurturing and seeing my buddies from Nightmare on Elm Street is probably my favorite thing to do. So you know, everything is pretty great right now.
Well, in terms of, even in terms of the, what are you noticing in terms of the filmmakers, the horror filmmakers, or just the directors you're meeting in general today versus then? You know, have they changed any? Have you seen just more enthusiasm, less enthusiasm? What are you experiencing out there?
Well, there were, you know, relatively few horror movies and even makeup effects films, yeah. I'd say 10 years ago, like when Dawn of the Dead came out, it was probably, I mean, every year there are maybe five like big studio horror movies.
Right,
so,
right.
You know, we had been involved in Dead Silence and mm-hmm. Some smaller movies that probably never got released, like one called Asylum, I remember doing. And they were a lot of competition to get those scripts, you yeah. know. And then once digital filmmaking kind of took over Hollywood, then I'd say, you know, there were 10, 20 times more projects
and
to vie for.
Yeah.
And everyone became a makeup effects artist,
yeah.
too.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
you know, we used to have maybe 5 to 10 competing shops when we would bid on jobs. And probably now there's more like 20 or even 30 people who are making good livings doing makeup effects. So I see the scripts that come in so that we break them down for, you know, bids.
Mm-hmm.
And the competition is super fierce. And so it's kind of everyone undercuts each other a little bit. I think the money was a lot better 10, 15 years ago. And so now you have to just do a lot more projects to kind of make the same kind of, you know, living. And you'd want to keep your crew employed as much as possible. You know, they're like your family. So you're just trying to get them work so that everyone can just not have to be laid off.
Yeah.
Did you meet your husband on a show? Like, was he making you up?
Or? Oh, actually, I mean, no. So I
wanted this to be a
so
dating
this is
show.
Like a really good story that nobody would ever believe. So, you know, Wes Craven, of course, is probably the most important person in my life.
Yeah.
So not only did he give me this role, but, I met a lot of really great people that had worked with him. And when he went off to do Serpent in the Rainbow, his producer, Marianne Maddalena, came back from Haiti and said, you know, I think you should meet David Anderson. And I was like, who's that? He's like, oh, he did all the makeup effects with his dad on the show. And he's just a really great guy. So when they had their wrap party for Serpent in the Rainbow, they invited me and I met David there and we were married like a year and a half later.
Wow.
That was like 30 years ago.
That's pretty solid. That's good. So That's good.
It's nobody would ever believe it. But so I thank Wes, God rest his soul.
Yeah.
And because my life would just be like absolutely shit if I didn't meet Wes Craven.
Oh my God.
What? And I know you would have, and Never Sleep Again in documentaries like that. But, and it's such an obvious question, but we've all met Wes in small capacities, but what made him such a unique director? Because I always tell people, like, it's not that he, like, you look at people like John Carpenter, who's like a natural director, but Wes is like, seems to be a natural, like, myth maker, somebody who's like telling us, it's about the story, not so much about film directing. It seems more, I don't want to say cerebral, but he just seems like a guy who you would meet at the campfire who would tell you the most amazing tale in that way. That's how I read it. But in your experience, especially with the three different incarnations of Nancy and the growth, like, what made him so unique?
Well, I mean, I think storyteller is actually the best way to describe him. But they weren't stories that he sometimes I don't think they came out of whole cloth from his brain.
Yeah.
He really looked out into the world for a story to tell. He didn't look into his own imagination and go, oh, Freddy Krueger and Nancy.
Yeah.
He really was inspired by things that he read about and he was very well read. And, you know, he had a great, you know, kind of wealth of imagination. But, you know, he also saw the world as a very, not that he was religious, but he was raised with a very yeah. religious viewpoint, which actually, you know, demarcates good and evil so clearly. And if anything, I think modern horror, those lines have been really blurred.
Yeah.
Like the idea of good versus evil, that there is a pure goodness and a pure evil in the world that battles, is something that kind of seems almost quaint, like everyone's so relative. And, you know, both sides, you know, let's yeah. just, you know, it's like you see it all the time in the way we talk about, like, but for Wes, that really, was to me, he was always very clear. And then on top of that, is he also had this very kind of 60s and 70s, like in the 60s and 70s, there was kind of this mind-opening awareness of psychology and motivation and things that he kind of laid on top of these other stories that, you know, had good and evil really at their core. And he was just so smart. And he's also kind of weird, you know. He was he was shy. He was very shy. He wasn't an extrovert. And I think he really liked being around people who are extroverted. Mm. He would kind of live through you. But he was really funny and also very so witty that I was very intimidated around him when I first got to know him, because everything he could just turn into a crazy joke or a crazy pun. And those people are just super, they're rare. They're very rare. You know, he wasn't comfortable around. I didn't get the feeling, like, talk about the opposite of, you know, what we're dealing with in Hollywood about these men, you know, who have these power trips. If anything, like, he could have probably benefited from being a little bit more powerful. I mean, he never came off as being overpowering or bossy. And mm-hmm. and he was so gentle the way that he wanted to get his idea across. And it was always very respectful. And I would just want, you know, you don't want anyone's memory to be tarnished by what's going on right now. And he just was always so gentlemanly mm-hmm. and so respectful of the people around him who worked for him.
Was there a big difference? Because I can imagine it was kind of like a family reunion with New Nightmare. But was it how different did it feel? Because obviously you had changed a lot in those years, I'm sure, and everyone's matured a lot. But how did the film feel similar as making the first, or was it radically different?
I mean, it seemed like a real Hollywood movie, you know, like the other ones all seemed so low budget. Like, yeah. You know, like we would go, like they would say, hey, break for lunch on the first one. And, you know, you'd go literally walk to the store down the street and get a sandwich and walk back to your dressing room. Like there was no craft service. There was no.
Really? The first one?
There was literally no craft service.
The funny thing is, the first one looks like a big movie. Like, as a viewer, it looks like a big, so, imaginative, amazing movie, you know?
And it was really, it was on such a shoestring. And to the credit of Bob Shea, I never felt that it was low budget. I didn't know there was supposed to be craft service. So let's just say that I was never aware until later. Yeah. But so Nightmare 3 had similar kinds of, there was such a big cast that they had to kind of pare down, like a lot of the stuff that you get to know on film sets. But 7 seemed to me like we'd really hit the big time. Like I just felt like, oh, the wardrobe, we're actually buying it at stores. We're not buying it at secondhand stores. Yeah. And literally, I think the wardrobe for both 1 and 3 came from like secondhand stores. We didn't buy anything new, and there was never doubles. I mean, as far as I could remember, it was like maybe a couple of outfits. You'd have 2 or 3 for stunt people, but like I just felt like we actually went to Warner Brothers to try on like clothes, and it was so nice, you know, and you hear that movies are made like that. And
well, it's funny, it's a lot of money for the one that's just set in the real world. The one where it's like just in your life
and you don't need any of that money. But they treated me really well. And you know, and Robert, of course, you know, he always just slides in a couple days here, a couple days there, and he always gets all the credit. But I'm always like, God damn it, I was there every day.
That's in the story of the movie too, which I love.
Yeah. Wes knew.
Second class citizen Nancy.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, because of how indelible the Nancy character is to you and your career, did it take you long to find her, to connect with her? Is there a lot of you in Nancy? Because, you know, I hear stories like Jamie Lee Curtis on Halloween. She's like, well, I wanted to be the PJ Souls character because that's who I was in real life. Like, I was not that character at all.
Interesting.
So I'm just curious if, it's one of those characters where I can't not separate her from you. So
I mean, I have to say I'm a lot like her, though I'm not nearly as kick-ass as she is. I'm not as brave.
No, you didn't booby-trap your house.
Though now that I've been Nancy, I can be more like Nancy, but I wasn't originally like her. Though I have taken so many cues from her in my life that now I feel, I can be Nancy, and because I know what that means to be her. But when I started, I played... I was I didn't even know Nancy was Nancy when I was playing the part. I just really felt like, oh, here she goes. She's going to go running up the stairway. And, oh, there's, you know, the stairways give way. And there's booby traps to set. I mean, every day I was just thinking about that little thing I had to do that day. And I never looked at her as this, like, overarching hero that was going to, you know, fight Freddy and all that. I didn't see that until I saw the movie. And even like in scenes like the bathtub scene, I just was so focused on like not having my boobs show and like the bubbles showing, like going in the right place to obscure, you know, my body. Like I was so concerned with what a 17, 18 year old girl would be concerned with that I didn't have the, you know, the mind or the presence of mind to say, oh my God, I'm playing this incredible character. And there was no one from the outside, like Entertainment Weekly or, you know, anybody coming onto the set going, you're playing such a hero. There was none of that. It was just, we were in a little bubble and we were all just working really hard. And there was no outside voices like coming at us like, you're going to be the next Jamie Lee Curtis. Or, you know, there was none of that outside like noise that makes you self-conscious about what you're doing.
And no expectations.
And a lot of girls, like, I always think of girls who have to play these heroes now. Like before the movie's even out, they're told like, this is the biggest hero that we've ever seen on screen. And they're like, really? So they get so much like, they get so much from the outside that it makes it hard, I think, to actually focus on what you're doing sometimes.
Mm. Did you, over the course of your career, did you have ups and downs with fandom and Nancy? I mean, like the kind of like Leonard Nimoy Spock thing where it's just
totally
like the push and pull of oh, I really hate this character because of all of these kind of outside fan elements. Or was there any...
It was never like... Leonard Nimoy. No, I mean, I think probably for the first 5 years, rarely recognized once in a while.
Yeah.
Like it never impinged on my daily life in a way where I'm eating and trying to have a romantic dinner with my husband and somebody comes in. That rarely, I don't think, ever happened. Actually, when I was on the TV show, it happened more. It was, you know, you have a big audience every week. Yeah. So when you go to the grocery store, the checker would say, oh my gosh, I loved you last week. But no fandom that is at all
value negative.
No negative sides to fandom as far as I can see.
That's great. That's great.
Well, also she's such a beloved final girl because unlike so many others, like I like Friday 13th movies a lot. I like watching them, but the final girls are just reacting to a situation. She, as far as I can tell, she's one of the first and only ones who it's completely outwitting the creature. I mean, it's completely done through your mind. You've thought of a plan and executed a plan. It's real. I can't think of any. I mean, Your Next recently kind of feels a bit like that at times. But yeah, there aren't many final girls where it feels like it's outsmarting the monster itself. And I feel like that's why people really love her, because I think that's the kind of role model people really need. It can't just be somebody who ran away and looked good running away from the beast. You need somebody, you kind of need that positive role model, I guess.
Yeah, I heard a term the other last weekend actually called teen noir. And I thought it was talking about Rebel Without a Cause actually, but then just talking about how these movies about worlds that teens reside in, where they are the agents of what they do and they're, you know, they're imperiled in some way and then they have to get out of their situation. And I thought that Nightmare on Elm Street actually was more like that than a slasher film, because the world that Wes creates really is just a teenage world where they have to cope with all this, you know, stuff that's happening in their life. And one of the things is Freddy Krueger, but it's rarely kind of entered by anybody else for the movie. The parents are there, but they're not really offering much, you know. If anything, the teenagers are trying to keep the parents away and take care of their own problems.
The parents created the problem.
Yeah, the parents created the problem.
They are
so
the problem.
Yeah, they've created this world that the teens have to navigate.
Deal with,
And I thought teen noir, I mean, I really liked that term. I'd never heard of it. And I started thinking about Nightmare as from that perspective, not so much as what we call like a slasher film, where it is kind of body count and it's more like, you know, how beautiful can the kids be who are going to get, you know, their head, you know, sliced off. So, but, yeah, you know, I think there's, America loves both, you know, obviously. Yeah.
I have a two-part question following up when you said, you know, not exactly knowing what the character was in the first one, but just kind of being yourself. Obviously, you came back for three. Did they ever talk to you about coming back for two? Or was that something that was just happening so fast that they didn't even think, like, let's bring the cast back from the first one?
I think the whole idea of sequels was just so new for Bob, for everybody. But Bob Shea was like, okay, what can we do? What can we do? And I think the house and the... that place what had so much soul to it. And Nancy, you know, life in that house had been so cool and rich. Her bedroom was so neat. I think Greg Fonseca, who had been the set design art director, had created such a magical place that it made a lot of sense to go back to the house as a nexus of all that action. But whether, I don't know whether Wes's involvement later on, you know, said, hey, let's just try Nancy and Freddie again. Let's try that again.
Right.
And because Wes really was devoted to the good and evil aspect of Nancy versus Freddie. And I think he obviously he stuck with it. And he always said to me, if he could see 1, 3, and 7 like matched together as a 3-box set, it would be really, he'd make him really happy, because he really felt that was the continuity that he wanted to like leave on film.
Right. And the second part of that question is, when you did come back for part three, as an actor, was there a little bit more pressure now because now there had been success to it? Like, were you a little more ambivalent about, well, how do I, like, I didn't really think about playing Nancy in the first one. I was just being myself. Now I have to actually be her.
Yeah. I mean, the part two had a little bit of a stretch to it. Like, oh, she's working at as a psychologist. I mean, it had kind of that phony soap opera quality to it that, we have to get her into the story, you know, let's make her, you know, this psychology student, a graduate student or whatever I am. I don't even really know, but, and she has all this quasi authority in a venue that she should never even be taken seriously. So I thought that was the biggest problem for me, is how do I make that situation real? Because I don't think it's really that buyable. I didn't buy it. And so some of the criticisms that came towards me after that performance were like, she doesn't sell that at all, you know? And I'm like, I didn't buy it either. You know, it was just really hard for me to
we
buy
did not
into
pick that.
Yeah. I bought it at 12 because no questions asked.
And you're 12, you would have bought it. But like, I'm telling them what drugs to prescribe. Yes, I mean, I'm not even like a doctor. I mean, it's a crazy scenario, but you can do that. I mean, Wes would always say, Heather, this is a dream. You know, whenever I would like ask about the logic.
But three is, I mean, in terms of fandom, I feel like I know so many people who three is one of their favorite movies of all time. Yeah. Like it I think it hit, I guess it's when sequels did it right. Not many sequels always hit that. It was a sequel that really got the creativity of the original. Yeah. But I mean, took
it's,
it to
yeah,
a bigger,
and it's also about teenagers in this horrible world, like horrible world. And I think every kid feels they're in that same world. Like every kid feels like they're being like watched, and that everything they do is like dangerous.
In a teenage noir.
Teenager's
in the noir.
And that, I think every kid can identify with one of those six.
Yeah, that's it, right?
Dream
there.
Warriors. Sure, and, you know, you were probably. You were the one with like walking
the puppets.
With,
I was probably
the
getting
puppet.
Puppeted.
You're a puppet.
He was definitely a wizard. Rob's a wizard.
I'm not the wizard. Come on, man. Wizard went out fast.
Really? But he was a wizard.
I love recasting. I love this casting.
I was
right
more
now.
Joey. I was the quiet
one. Oh, the nude.
You were the one who got to hang out with the nude nurse. Got it.
Well, all right.
Ryan was more Zsa Zsa Gabor.
That is so funny. No, but don't you feel like everybody, you can just ask them, who are you? And that's
Oh, totally.
They can tell you.
Yeah,
they can tell you. Ryan, well, I mean, who are you?
I have no Zsa Zsa Gabor.
Zsa Zsa Gabor. I mean, clearly,
I was more. I don't know.
Ryan's the wizard. Come on.
Oh, he's got the glasses. Yeah,
he's got the glasses. No, I mean, I remember when the movie came out. I remember seeing a full page ad in the New York Times. One of my greatest Sunday traditions growing up was grabbing the New York Times and looking at the movie section. And because that was the time when they would just pour ads into that section, it would just be a full page ad. And I remember I grabbed the Nightmare on Elm Street 3 because it came color. And I was like, oh, this
and
is.
And it's that great poster where the kids are
the
walking.
The kids are on the blades. And I would draw each one out and go, and, you know, it was great.
You be as honest to you, as dishonest as you want, but how did it feel watching the sequels you weren't in? I'm always curious what that must feel like because you say you do have such a great through line, but like 2 does feel like a strange offshoot and it has its fandom as well. They all have their different fans. Yeah, even, which is what most maligned, is it?
6?
Freddy's dead.
Yeah. Even 6, we have friends who literally, they love it.
And you're always like, co-host who isn't here tonight.
Yeah. No, she does. Yeah, you're right.
God.
But like especially 2, I guess, because 1 was obviously became this phenomenon and just going to the theater, what was that experience like? Is it totally bizarre?
Well, I actually didn't see any of the other films in theater. I've only seen them, you know, on cable or, you know, just screenings that friends will have. And so I didn't get the benefit of seeing them on the big screen, which actually is too bad. People who didn't get to see them on the big screen, you don't get that same sense of the magnificence of Freddy, you know. But I watched the other ones. Some of them I feel like there's a lot of creativity and a lot of direction that's really amazing and that they always picked, you know, young directors who had so many ideas. And I respect the ideas. But I just don't feel like a lot of the stories have that gravity. Yeah. They don't feel as important, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
But that's just me.
The large stakes.
Did you see the remake? No. Yeah, I still haven't seen it.
I still haven't seen it.
You don't have to.
I don't want to.
Yeah.
I don't want to see it. I love Nightmare on Elm Street too much.
Freddy's too short. And when it came out, I remember telling Rob, there was only one quote I remember from Roger Corman, and he was like, yeah, in my experience, the monster should at least be taller than the female protagonist. And then I watched that movie and went, oh, they failed the Corman test because he's like tiny and the girl's waiting. You're like, I'm not feeling very threatened.
Well, what Robert always says is that, you know, he has so many nice things to say about it, but the makeup that he wore had a lot of, there was just more silhouette in the dark. Because a lot of times Freddy's in the shadow. And that the makeup, unfortunately, just didn't have that striking quality that, so that when it was in shadow or just partially shown, it didn't have that, you know, edge to it that Freddy Krueger and his hat.
Well, if there'd never been sequels, we always talk about how
I always say
if there's never been sequels, that's the scariest movie ever made. In my opinion, like the sequels help you almost deal with it. They're almost like cathartic. Thank God I can laugh. But that first film is like, that's terrifying. Let's straight. Yeah.
You know what?
I was thankful
for the sequels actually because I was so
terrified.
I needed to draw out Freddy Krueger or go buy the toy because I was fucking terrified.
Maybe that's why they're so popular.
I think it is. No, I think
you could
a lot
smash
of the,
it if you wanted. You know, you had power over
exactly,
the toy.
Or just draw it, you know, like erase it. I'm curious. I'm curious about the truth. I love kind of dissecting New Nightmare. I'm curious about the truths of New Nightmare and what Wes, what was depicted as very real. You know, I mean, obviously, Nightmare came out in 1994. I don't know when you met your husband.
So I had been married for, you know, 5 years probably.
Okay,
and I had a 3-year-old boy.
Okay, yeah.
So,
but I mean, in terms of like your dynamic with Wes, your dynamic with Robert, I mean, like.
It was more glamorous in the movie.
Yeah. And I actually love the scene.
I didn't drive nearly as cool a Volvo. I still had a Volvo, though. And that's so weird.
When I walked
into the house the first day that they come, you know, we're going to go to your house today. And I walked around. It wasn't like my house is way crappier than that house, but there was so many elements of that I would have picked out. I mean, they just knew how to make it look like something I would have picked.
That is cool.
A lot of stuff and the way, you know, the kitchen was arranged and the pots and pans. I mean, I felt like, oh, this is my kitchen. You know? And they did a good job with that. A lot of the things that you see, I was very happy that that's the Heather Langenkamp that they, you know, they chose to portray because it was fiction. I mean, it's, I'd say 70%, well, 60% fiction, 40% really me.
Well, there's a great scene. And when you go into New
Like, I didn't have a nanny. I never had a
nanny. Oh, okay. Yeah. She was a great nanny.
She was.
Yeah, she was great.
Tracy Hittendorf, great nanny.
She tweeted at me once, and I was like, oh, hey, nanny from New Nanny.
Would get excited about that.
I was super excited. I'd love the moment when you walk into New Line Cinema, and the receptionist is like, and you are? And you're like,
Okay, now that, so that is true. Yeah. So
there we go.
Score.
So I'll tell you, but it happens all the time. So it wasn't like a particular time, but I'll often call Wes's office or I'll call like New Line and I'll say, this is Heather Langenkamp. And like, can you spell that for me? I'm like, sure. Why don't you turn around, look at the poster behind you. It says starring Heather Langenkamp. That's how you spell it.
Nice.
But, so when we finished working on, Cabin in the Woods.
Yeah.
We were wrapping down and my friend comes in and says, oh, I'm going to go see Nightmare on Elm Street at the Egyptian Theater tonight. And I think Wes is going to be there. And I said, no way. I'm going to call him. I'd love to go see it on the big screen and maybe we can go together. So I call his secretary and again, it's like, how do you spell your last name? Oh. And I'm like, Langenkamp, just tell him I called. And then I hung up the phone and my sister-in-law who was working with me at the time, she was one of, you know, my main helpers. She's like, God damn it. You're Nancy. Like, how can they not know how to spell your name? I'm so furious about that. I want to make a documentary and we're going to call it I Am Nancy. And we're going to go all around and tell people how to spell your fucking last name. and so I'm like, yeah, right. And so after we wrapped Cabin in the Woods, that's what we did. We made the documentary, Nancy, I Am Nancy. Yeah, yeah. And it was all based on the fact that secretary didn't know how to spell my name. And it ended up being a great experience. But it was something that did bother me a great deal.
Where did that documentary end up, by the way? Because I know, was it a bonus feature on something or did it get its own release?
So I self-released it. I just sell it on Amazon and on my website and iamnancy.net. And so I've actually was just telling my daughter, I said, I'm really happy that I just released it myself because I think I've made so much more money.
Yeah.
When I hear about people getting like their 3 cents for every Netflix view, yeah. I'm like, oh, good. Okay. I'm ahead. I'm ahead there. But yeah, so it's, I've sold maybe, I don't know, I've sold probably like 15,000 copies maybe or 10,000.
Oh, wow.
So
that's fantastic.
Yeah, that's great.
I'm totally happy with it. But, It's now, you know, you can stream it. I'm sure it's everywhere, but it was about like establishing, like, I wanted to tell the world that I'm aware that Nancy's important, but I need to hear it from you guys. I just needed to hear like what people thought about Nancy. And so I was gratified to know that people really did care about her. And it was tongue in cheek though. It was very tongue in cheek.
Have your kids seen the original Nightmare yet?
Yeah. Well, my kids are 26 and 23 now. So,
were they young?
I was going to say, how young did they wind up?
You know what? I never ever showed it to them. Yeah. I just wanted them to experience it like every kid, which is like, they're at a slumber party and someone's like, let's watch Nightmare on Elm Street. So when they did see it, a couple days went by and they're like, oh yeah, mom, we saw your movie.
And I can't imagine what it's like to see your mom as a teen heroine who's kicking the monster's ass. Yeah. Like, just imagine being Jamie Lee watching Psycho for the first time and sitting at, you know.
It makes them uncomfortable. I mean, it makes them uncomfortable. I think I've always believed that I never wanted my kids to know that I was an actor because all the kids of actors that I know are just, they have a lot of problems.
Yeah.
Not all of them, but a lot of them do because their parents are so successful or they have this great career. They have something that everybody knows them for. And I think it puts, like, a kid goes, well, what am I supposed to do now? Like, where's my place in the world?
Yeah.
And how am I ever going to be like anybody if my mom is like Nancy? So we kept it really low key. And so when they finally did see it, they've never told me they liked it, so
I love that about kids of horror icons. Yeah. They always are like downplay, like, yes, those are
but
right.
But watch them Spore. Show off at the Spore. Slumber party to their friends.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I bet you anything. Yeah.
I know at college, I know it was mentioned like within the first 5 minutes of their dorm, I'm sure. I know.
Which is pretty badass. That's really cool. Did you, I'm curious, towards the end with Wes, did he ever, New Nightmare really like the final story? And the relationship between those two characters as far as Wes
was concerned? So,
yeah, in terms of his vision, did he ever say anything more about it?
I never had a chance to, I mean, I never talked to him about, like, do you have a fourth, you know, another installment for me, Wes?
Because it does have finality to it. I mean, it feels like a nice, perfectly closed loop in there.
I think that probably he thought it was closed, though, you know, nowadays nothing's ever closed. I do wonder if he ever thought about it. Yeah. But I know that for Nightmare 7, he had to think a long time before he came up with that idea.
Yeah.
I mean, Marianne Maddalena tells me that he really struggled to find that idea that would transcend the regular movie being another sequel. And I think when he thought of that idea of making it was like a total eureka moment. And it actually is a big moment because of people say meta, but you know, it's really a transformation in breaking the fourth wall and like having all this crazy idea about filmmaking in it.
And him being in it is as a
so
director is just so
weird.
Ballsy. It's just like there's something about when he pops up and you're like, oh wow, he's so confident in playing himself. You're like, that's so interesting.
Well, also Bob Shea as well.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny. I just went to see, I went to David Lynch's Festival of Disruption
last weekend.
And so they had this movie about LA Plays Itself, which is about,
I've seen it. It's great.
And have you seen that documentary?
Well, the guy's
3 hours
hilarious.
Long, first of all. So I was really hungry
by
then.
And he's a total curmudgeon. I love this voiceover. He's like, rah, rah, rah.
Like, he was a very sad child. But all of his observations are just right on. But one of them that I loved is that all of these people who are in positions of power live in these postmodern houses. So if you look in Nightmare 7, Wes is in this
amazing,
like, cold white like Malibu villa looking over the ocean. And Wes actually lived in this like really charming kind of, it was modern, but it wasn't like that sterile, really modern thing. And I thought, why this house, Wes?
That's
this
funny.
Is totally not you. In his real house, he has like billions of books and photography and beautiful things. And this house just, I'm like, why aren't you portraying yourself as how you are? You know, instead you're this kind of like sterile, like living alone on top of a mountaintop kind of thing.
Yeah.
And, I just thought it was funny that that's how he
ready to reveal himself
all the
way.
It's like the artist isn't ready to pour it all.
Typical director.
He doesn't want to give away his entire personality. But of course, he expected me to do it, so it's funny.
Yeah. Well, also, that's funny because there's a direct lineage to that film to Cabin in the Woods. The fact that you're working on Cabin in the Woods is kind of mind blowing because between that Scream and Cabin in the Woods, you have the three perfect referential films.
I know. Isn't it true? And and I always say that Cabin in the Woods is probably my favorite modern horror movie because. Wes's movie ends on such a positive note, and then Cabin in the Woods is like the opposite. And you know, Wes was never a nihilist he never had the sense that the world was going to, you know, end because of Freddy. And he always felt like there was always hope. And then you work, you know, when you do a movie where there is no hope, it's, it was very cool. I appreciate both extremely well. And that's when things are kind of in the middle and don't want to take a stand or they leave it ambivalent. I'm like, oh no, I want one or the other.
How could anyone think he was a nihilist after Last House on the Left? How would anyone ever think? Did you? And I'm actually really interested to hear this. When you were cast in the first Nightmare, did you, because now in the modern IMDb, we all look each other up, but did you like look him up and were at all concerned by the previous, because the movies before that are crazy.
Tell me, kind sir, how would I have looked him up?
I don't know. I don't know how things are done. Video story.
The encyclopedia of 20th century horror? No.
You didn't call Leonard Maltin and say, Leonard, I need a...
That was what's so funny about it, is it was like the dinosaur era.
Yeah.
I really didn't even know that he had any movies that he had. And then Robert Englund said, he directed Last House on the Left. And I'm like, that sounds like a nice movie about...
It's like Little House on the Prairie.
Have dinner, at the Last House on the Left.
And then I asked someone else, I said, have you ever seen this movie, Last House on the Left? He's like, yeah, I threw up. I had to turn it off. You know? I'm like,
wow.
And then I said, oh crap. I mean, yeah. I'm like, why is he making this movie then? Because this movie seemed to me like really wholesome in comparison to what I had heard about Last House on the Left. Mm. And then I just kind of must have chalked it up to like youthful indiscretion or like a bad drug trip or something. And then I just thought it couldn't be the same guy. It just couldn't be the same
guy. And somebody's like, and the pornography he was making before that. And then the list gets worse and worse.
But I didn't even hear about that until years later, until IMDb comes out. And then I'm like, holy crap.
Yeah, yeah. You know? Wes lived the life. That's cool.
Yeah. What, tell us some stories from Cabin in the Woods. You know, I mean, like that, I think that's a film that we hear from a lot of like that kind of.
Well, I really wanted to have a part in that movie. And so I would put these like stupid hints like in the shop. So I took a picture of me as Nancy sitting on the bed with Freddie.
Yeah.
Freddie's like behind me, like reaching for me. And then I put a thought bubble that said, I really wish I could be in Cabin in the Woods.
I love
the subtlety.
So when Drew Goddard came over to like approve some designs, I was like putting the picture like,
yeah,
in front of him. I didn't have the guts to ask him.
But did he know that you were on the show?
I think so, definitely. But I know that it's awkward to be an actor working behind the, you know, below the line, let's say.
Sure.
Because people are like, oh, poor thing. You know, her career's in, you know, nowhere. And so she's now like a secretary. So there's like some people who probably think that.
Yeah.
And then, other people, they don't know who I am, so that's fine. And then there's someone in their office will say, yeah, that's Heather Langenkamp. And then they'll be like, who's that? And she's like, she's a Nightmare on Elm Street. And you can see this little conversation happening like across the room. And then you're just trying to be cool. And basically what I do now is I just try to get it out on the table right away. Like I'll make some kind of comment like, oh, this movie reminds me so much of Wes Craven. Or, you know. Mm-hmm. Because I don't want it to be this like awkwardness, like they feel like they didn't know who I was, and then I don't even care if they know who I was, but I don't want them to find out later and then feel embarrassed. And so it's like this little dance I do so that, you know, people who come in who don't know that maybe I'll be answering the door, you know, then they get the message pretty quickly from me, like, yeah, I'm Heather. I was in Nightmare on Elm Street. Okay, let's move on.
The funny thing is you could totally have played Sigourney's role. I mean, Sigourney's obviously a name that maybe helped finance the movie for all I know, but that role to me could have totally been a Nancy, you know, Nancy in that world.
I know. I feel like there's this like universal like stop sign or something in front of me. Like every time, I can't explain it, but one day we were sitting around a big table in Joss Whedon, and we were in Canada, and we were talking about this scene we called the Costco of Death, because there was like 900 different creatures and they were all coming out, you know, when the things go crazy.
Yeah, it's great.
And there was some makeup effect and some little scene that Joss Whedon was like really excited about. And to me, it was just, I'll just say it, revolting. And I made some kind of really like bad joke about it, and he did not appreciate it.
What did you say?
Well, it was about some characters who were like, you know, it was really raunchy and really sexual, like depraved sexual psych thing he wanted to like put on screen, but it was like a joke. But I kind of made a joke like, well, how the hell are we gonna make that, you know? Are you gonna come in for a life cast? Or like I made some kind and it was all creepy, and I remember thinking to myself, God, why did I open my fucking mouth, and I'm so stupid. And he looked at me like, oh, you made a big mistake, Heather. You shouldn't have said that. But who knows? I mean, he was charming in most, you know, most of the time. And he's super talented. So the end product of the movie is so good. And I was so proud that we got to even work on it. But there's just, you know, it's just weird, you know, being an actor and then trying to like talk to people like you have a brain, you know, it's like they don't believe you.
Yeah.
Well, I need to bring this up because I just realized that you worked with a friend of ours. You're in Nick Simon's Truth or Dare.
Oh,
and Nick Simon was a protege of Wes.
Yeah. I know. And it's funny because he asked me to do that part because the writer was a good friend of mine.
Uh-huh.
And oh, it was he's one, a really good director, but the movie is really, it has so many gross things in it. Like, I thought I had a strong stomach after American Horror Story. I've seen like so many gruesome things, and we've made a lot of them. And then they just one-upped every single thing I thought would could never be done on, especially, you know, for a television movie. But of course, there's no censors or anything now, but just body parts that are cut off and like girls doing like crazy things that like, I hope no teenagers ever have to do. Not just girls, boys or girls, but the two leads are girls who, you know, and so they end up just going for all this gore that I never thought was going to make it onto the final cut. And it's all there, man. It's all there.
Well, I know this just premiered.
Really good. Yeah, sci-fi, right?
I think it was, yeah.
I haven't seen it. I got to watch it.
I hope it'll, I'm sure they'll repeat it sometime this
month. Well, I get to wear like full burn makeup too, like Robert Englund.
Oh,
because I always was jealous of him. And so I've worn makeup effects like a couple times now. I was a character in Star Trek Into Darkness. Mm-hmm. And then I got to wear this like burn makeup. It was really fun. And I think I'm like so... I'm so glad that now as I'm getting older, now I can wear makeup effects.
Did you see any horror before you were in Nightmare, before you entered this world? Because it's amazing to be on the other side now where you're doing, you know, in the effects world where you just see everything. It's just such interesting. But before that, were you naive to that whole culture?
You mean before Nightmare?
Yeah, before Nightmare.
Sure. I mean, the only horror movies I remember seeing was actually a movie that I think is ripe for a remake. Mm. Is Burnt Offerings.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Ooh.
And that was like when, and the Karen Black, of course, was like my favorite actress. Mm-hmm.
And that pool scene is crazy.
The pool scene and the whole house deteriorating was so scary to me, that whole concept of the.
You're right. That actually totally could be remade. It's.
Well, even the driver with that big grain on his sunglasses.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
it's a
disorienting. But it was subtle. It wasn't gory. It was, it was more psychological and creepy. And so that was the first. And of course, I kind of probably snuck into like 5 seconds of The Exorcist at some point. I mean, I remember scenes from it, but I don't think I saw the whole thing. And, but you know, things like Wizard of Oz to me were gore. I mean, I was like from Oklahoma. I mean, we just didn't see like a lot of scary things.
Yeah. Wizard of Oz and Willy Wonka, those two scared the crap
really
out of me.
Really scary.
Not horror movies, those two.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So.
In the course of doing American Horror Story, I mean, like, I'm very curious about the process. You said you were on for 4 seasons.
Yes,
now?
So we just finished the last cult. Just finished that,
which
season.
I have to catch up. I'm 2 episodes in, and I've got a back catalog. I've got to catch up on. So on a show like that.
Usually, I rolled my eyes batshit crazy.
Yeah. Usually I think the kind of common feeling is, let's watch American Horror Story season, you know, the newest season. Oh my God, that episode was crazy. And then it's like,
I don't know if
and then the second episode, you're like, I don't know if I can do. And then the third episode, you're like, no, I'm back in again. And they're just going to keep pushing over.
It's pushed. Yeah. I mean, I keep thinking when I first started, I mean, we started on Freak Show.
Well, full Cheeto face. I mean, like in Cult, when he starts rubbing. rubbing Cheetos on his face.
That
I was like,
the Trump color.
Well, this is usually a episode 4 reveal, but they're just going 4 minutes in.
Yeah, that was the first scene.
Yeah.
Well, it is. I've always thought I respect people who want to break taboos, like who want to go to the taboos that we have in our society and turn them over. And then now that, you know, I've seen so many taboos fall, I don't know if it's good anymore. I'm like, we need to like really think about it.
No, that's interesting. Yeah.
I think taboos exist for a societal reason to keep us all kind of on the straight and narrow. And I mean, I admire Ryan Murphy, I mean, so much, but there are certain taboos that even when I see them in the script, I'm like, oh my gosh. I mean, what's left? I mean, there's very little left in that universe and if you don't have taboos, then how can you have horror, actually?
Exactly,
it becomes like everything becomes done.
Yeah.
And so it'll be interesting to see like what our grandchildren's, quote, taboos are after this generation.
Yeah, I'm always curious about the horror will always be around, but the challenges for, you know, companies like ours is how do you shock people? And how do you not necessarily shock people, but scare people in the world of YouTube and Vine and Instagram?
It's really, really hard.
But at the end of the day, it's about emotion. You know,
yeah,
how do you touch people and how do you connect on a character level? And yeah. Then once those people are with the character, then they'll be scared.
But also my feeling is that I find people live at a much heightened level of fear in their daily life.
Yeah.
So that to get them to that place where they are actually like jumping out of their seat is really hard. It's almost like they're frogs in the hot water. The water is now really boiling hot for most people, so that there's not much farther you can go before they're just dead.
Yeah,
dead
yeah,
frogs, yeah. You know. And I feel like that little tiny difference is where horror has to like live. And in the olden days, the water was much cooler, and so you had this whole range that you could occupy to scare people. But now I don't even really know where the range is. And so that's why I think horror like has to depend so much on humor and also irony, and it has to inside baseball about other horror movies that scared you a long time ago. And it's really hard to find in that little tiny space that where the real scare is going to be. And like, I asked my daughter, what are you afraid of? She's like, spiders. I'm like, okay, great. Like, her fears are like so primal
fears.
And traditional. Yeah. I'm like, whew, she's normal.
Well,
she's
there's also the cathartic nature of horror, because, you know, there was a great article that dropped in the last week about how horror has never been hotter right now. I mean, some of the biggest hits this year because of how much fear there is in the world.
But a lot of them are nostalgic too. Like, I feel like, you know, a big part of it is because Stranger Things and it's because it took place not now.
Right.
It took place in a different time. That feels like a nice, we want to go back to them. I'm sure people in the 80s had a lot of problems about Reagan and a lot of rage too, but we're in a time now where it does feel kind of hopeless, and that's never a great place to be. Like when you feel about your government and stuff, I feel hopeless. It's a strange thing. Off record, we were talking before the show just a little bit, and I did want to just hear you weigh in because in a way, I think, you know, you might not feel like an icon, but the character is an icon in terms of a woman, a female character who really just kicks ass. And in the last week, we're in an absolute shitstorm of the culture. I mean, it's about misogyny in general, but clearly it's right now focused on the entertainment industry. So I was curious about your thoughts about if you've seen, you know, change in that. Obviously, the floodgates are kind of opening, right? But have you seen it change in a positive way over the last, you know, 30 years for your experiences? Or does it seem like it's the same thing?
It's so funny because when I got started, you know, it seemed to me like Hollywood and kind of the casting couch and men taking advantage of their positions of power just went totally hand in hand. Like, if you entered this business thinking that wasn't going to happen to you, then you had a big surprise ahead for you. And so, it's like, whether I was like Nancy or not doesn't really make a difference. But whenever I had those experiences in my life from whoever, it doesn't have to be a director, didn't have to be a producer, but there was just this general, there was certain sleazy people around, just Hollywood attracted a certain kind of person that would try to take advantage of you if they could. Mm. And I don't think there's a lot of businesses. It's not just Hollywood, of course. You've heard that. But I would always fend them off. Like,
Nancy.
So, but in like really stupid ways. Like, so, you know, I'd quit. Like, I worked in production before I got a lot of jobs. As an actor, I would, you know, work on documentaries or I'd do things in Hollywood to kind of figure this business out. And if there was someone who was untoward or did something creepy, I'd just literally not show up. And I just would say, I'm not going to be around while you do this. I mean, I just leave. And then I realized over time, like, wow, my chances for promotion were completely completely squashed.
Yeah.
Cause I never thought like, well, that's not fair. I should be able to stay and I should be able to. So I just would get out and I would just flee. And, often, you know, you think back on, wow, that was a sleazy guy. Oh my God, that happened too. Oh yeah. Then there was that time, you know, and then you're like, I just started remembering and I'm like, yeah, but I always thought, it's worth it for me just to walk out of the room than it is. My career was never that important, like that I would let somebody do that to me, I guess.
Yeah.
But on the flip side, I would often look at folks that I knew who maybe were taking advantage of that situation. And I did see sometimes like, wow, how did she get that part? And I'd be like kind of naive, like, huh. But I don't want to say that that was probably the basis of it. Yeah. But I know on times that it was the basis of it. I've seen directors when I already had the part interviewing other women and then listening to them talk about the next woman that was going to be cast in ways that was just really not acceptable. I mean, I got married when I was 18, and sometimes I think back thinking, not to David, but I had another husband, yeah. and I thought, you know, that was a protective, as much as I loved him, but yeah. I mean, it was a protective measure because right. when I was in rooms with people and I had a wedding ring on and I was 18,
yeah.
men did not treat me the same way. Right. And I can tell you like right now, sometimes I think that was my protective device. And so I got out of a lot of situations by just going, oh, my husband's at home waiting for me. Yeah. He probably has dinner on the table. Gotta go.
Yeah.
You know, but I was constantly like helping other people like escape, you know, situations that were a lot more dire. And nowadays it's way better. I mean, I hate to say these things that are happening this week have shed a light, but there's just a lot more women around. I mean, there's like a lot of women who have their eyes on the ball and know, okay, maybe they're not jumping in every moment that they could and fending off, you know, bad situations. But because there's more women around, I feel like I think everyone is feeling more comfortable with the dynamics of power in our
it's keeping the predators away.
But anyway, like, there's predators so you know everywhere.
Yeah, of course,
everywhere. Yeah. And
it feels like there's now more of a willingness to open up about it.
Awareness,
a collective, yeah, collective.
But I mean, and I have to say, I mean, my thing is that someone said it, you know, guys who are being raised to think that that's okay. Or that there's something funny or humorous about it, or a woman might be flattered by it. I think that that's a matter of education. And I do feel like it's a matter of, you know, maybe the, you know, maybe we're just not, we're not imparting enough messages about that to young men. And I feel like I really take that mission seriously. Mm-hmm. And I do think that going forward, I think a lot of women and men, dads and moms are saying, okay, am I giving this information to my kid properly? Am I letting them watch porn? Am I letting them like not have real relationships with women, like encouraging them to have friends who are from both sexes? Because I do feel like sometimes like there's guys out there who just until they become a powerful man, like just never had like probably that many great relationships with women.
I think a lot of the ones that have come up in the last, from the Harry Knowles to there's this list of people, they all kind of have that in common. Yeah. Somebody who was a key nerd who then suddenly had a lot of power.
Yeah.
And you're like, bad cocktail,
I mean,
you know?
It seems like it's a stereotype, but perhaps there's something to it. And I do hear kids talk about how lonely they are, how it's hard for them to meet like girls or girls to meet guys. There's like a lot of, because of phones, because of entertainment, you know, there's just a lot of barriers
to
having normal, like, let's hold hands. I mean, come on, that never happens.
You beat Freddie. I think that's pretty cool. I feel like that makes you a pretty awesome role model.
Heather, so you, before we came on, you said you had a radio show?
Yeah, so I have a pseudonym, though. I don't, it's not.
Oh, are we allowed to talk about this then?
Sure, why not?
Okay, all right.
So it's a low power FM station in Malibu called KBU, KBUU 97.5. And so one of my friends started the station literally in his spare bedroom when his kids moved out. And it was always his dream to start a low power, you know, FM station. So we have the smallest license in like the world, I think, for an FM station. We have 69 watts like blazing out over Zuma Beach pretty much. And so I have a show. So I've always loved, I don't know if you, like I used to go to Colorado a lot and there were little local stations that just were like so full of soul, like you just knew where you were by listening to the radio. And before, you know, Sinclair took over everything. Yeah. And so I'm like, I'm going to model my show off after these kind of hometown radio stations. So I have a pseudonym. My name's Sandy Bottoms. And
I love it. Sandy Bottom for a beach show.
I love it so
and
much.
So all I do is talk about the weather and the surf, and then I'll talk about like how there's a pie festival on Saturday and you want to make sure you get your entry form in. It's all true.
She's like basically like a real life like Adrienne Barbeau from The Fog.
From The Fog,
it's just like you up in a lighthouse just talking about stuff.
Just talking about like my town, because I, you know, I feel like small town America is pretty much dead.
Yeah.
And a lot of it's because there's no radio. There's no local TV anymore. Yeah, everything is just so national and worldly. And so I just told the director, his name is Hans. Hey, Hans. I'm going to do this corny, super corny show. And I let, because I'm not a big, like, I don't know what super tunes of the day are or anything. So I let the computer pretty much pick all the songs from the 80s and 90s that I liked. And they just, like, if you listen to my show, you'll hear like, Chrissy Hines singing like, you know, Brass in Pocket every week. So it's like,
I'm going to boost the signal out to Glendale. I want to hear this.
Yeah.
But you can go on. It's on the net. I mean, it's on the web too. You can go to.
You can stream it.
All right.
What is it? 97.5 KBU. And you can hear us anywhere in the world at radiomalibu.net.
You've got to slip in a Fat Boys tune in there. I think you owe it to, the nightmare people.
Yeah. Okay. I've looked. In our catalog is pretty slim.
Okay.
But I'll definitely.
Or even A Nightmare on My Street.
Yeah.
Well, but
I'm going to play that this Saturday because it's Halloween.
Excellent.
I have a whole Halloween set I'm going to play.
Do know that your voice is in the Fat Boys single, Are You Ready for Freddy? Because
because what do I say? Like, I say something like.
It's dialogue from the movie. Fred Krueger, Mom.
Fred Krueger.
Yeah.
Right.
That, and then they're rapping over it. It's amazing.
Okay, I'm going to find it. I'll upload it.
That's
and
cool.
I'll play it this weekend.
Amazing.
But anyway, I don't have many listeners, but from time to time, I have to take a weekend off and I have to I can't do it. And the director told me that one person called to ask what happened to Sandy Bottom. I have one
That's
listener.
Great.
This podcast, we're going to boost your numbers.
We're going to throw some links in there.
It's Saturday at 10 to 12.
That's
it's
amazing.
A short little show.
Listen up, Malibu people.
Saturday 10 to 12 in the evening?
No, in the morning.
Oh, in the morning. Okay.
I get up really early. I'm very dedicated. Yeah. So I get up at about 5 a.m. I have my coffee. I go and go through all the newspapers. I go to, you know, in case there's a big story.
Yeah.
I always talk about the Dodgers because they're my favorite. But now that the end of the season's approaching, I'll have to find something else to talk about. But, you know, there's little politics. Like they're going to ban straws in Malibu coming up. It's like a very big deal.
We talk about Rick Springfield driving the PCH all the time.
Yeah.
Every time I go into PCH, it's fucking Rick Springfield just cruising up and down the PCH.
Poor guy. He's in American Horror Story this season. Yeah.
Oh, really?
Oh, can't wait.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
That's great.
Yeah. I think so. Yeah, I'm pretty sure. But anyway, it's, you know, a lot of people think, oh, Malibu Beach and like rich people. No. There's this whole seedy underbelly of Malibu that I am part of, like PTA soccer mom. Like,
I don't know if seedy is the word.
Okay, not seedy. How about just regular?
Regular.
Like super regular people and charming, like local town vibe.
Yeah.
But most people don't see that when they just, you know, go there to go to Nobu or,
you
know.
I want you to have a super edgy show called Teenage Noir, and it's just you getting under the skin of modern teens.
I'm thinking about
You'd
something
be badass.
Like that.
There
I
you
think
go.
I would. I could really bring in some cool observations.
You'll be like the crank going, yeah, we need boundaries. There's teenagers need, what do we got?
Where are the taboos?
We need taboos. In my day, we had Freddy Krueger.
Talk about that all day long. Where are the taboos?
Taboo number one, starting today.
Yeah.
No killing babies in movies.
No, that's what I was going to say, but I think I got
You read your mind.
I think, you did read my mind. Is that still a taboo? I don't think so.
Well, no, because it got thrown out the window with...
it's happened in movies, but I still feel it sometimes. It depends how well it's done, because sometimes I'll be like, oh, they killed the baby. Like the dog.
Killed the baby.
Killing the animal or the kid is still...
American Horror Story.
Killing animals is way more taboo than killing kids.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah. People feel it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Where'd that come from?
I don't know.
Yeah.
One bit.
Well.
Yeah. Pet Sematary?
We got to come up with, guys, I think we need to come up with our Malibu radio names.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, we're going to do that.
Okay.
Next time
you can't beat Sandy Bob. You can't take Coral Reef because that's my husband's name.
Oh, damn it. Ryan's like, that's the one I had.
What about Dusty Cliffs?
Such a strong, firm name.
Yeah. I'm going to say Dusty Cliffs.
That's Elric.
Yeah.
Or
I'm Hans Breeze. A little shout out to your Hans.
Well, Heather, thank you so much for coming
out.
That was great.
That was really appreciated. Thank you for having me. I'm very honored to be part of your show. And good luck. I hope my ratings someday can be as
We're going to boost you. We're going to boost you.
Are you around on the social medias? Do you have a Twitter?
Oh, I do. I have a Twitter. It's Langenkamp H.
Mm-hmm. How do you spell Langenkamp? I'm just kidding. I'm messing with you.
What a dick.
You had me. I also was about to start spelling.
That's a reference to the show.
You're so witty.
Yeah, thanks.
Langenkamp H.
I have a little website, iamnancy.net.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And find your doc.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I usually like announce where I'm going to go for these shows around the world.
There was Heather, I'll tell you, there was one time I was traveling for work at Blumhouse and I was at LAX and I saw you like two people up ahead and I was like, I think you were going to like a convention on the East Coast or something. I was going to the East Coast as well, but I wasn't going to the show.
Don't tell them that I fly coach, please.
No, not at all. No, but this is how nerdy I got because I was wearing my jacket and my slasher jacket because I got like all these buttons.
Oh, you did.
And I had like Jason and Michael and I was like, oh fuck, I don't have a Freddy button.
So you can't talk to her?
I was like, I can't say anything. I'm not going to say anything.
Oh, man, that's funny.
Grown man, Ryan Turek, 1 year ago.
Did you get that remedied, that problem?
I did, actually.
Okay.
I can help you out with that. I have a lot of, Freddy swag I can give you.
Well, Elric and I are in for that.
Does somebody have the Nancy phone with the tongue? Does that still exist, the phone?
I mean, it must exist. Have it. People think I do, but people are making really good replicas.
Okay, yeah, good.
Yeah.
I'm sold.
Yeah, we need a Nancy action figure.
Well, there is
one, isn't there?
Not an action.
I think maybe they did like this, the set of like her in the bed with him. Did they do like a, what are those called?
It's kind of like a tableau. It's kind of like a, it's like a 3D poster, they call it. A 3D poster. But I'm working on getting that. I really want
Listen
that.
Up, Todd McFarlane.
Yeah.
What's the company that makes those really cool Marvel action figures, the Hot Toys or Sideshow Collectibles or something like that? We do need a Funko version of Nancy.
Funko.
Oh, yeah.
All the little Funko guys.
I love those. Are my favorite.
They should just create a Final Girls line.
Yeah. There we go.
Listen to me, Funko.
Yeah. Exactly. Pitching great ideas.
All right.
Thank you again, Heather. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. You guys have a happy Halloween.
You too.
It's
the favorite month of the year.
Wait, hang on a second. What is Halloween like in Malibu? Is it just like pumpkins on the beach?
No, they have one neighborhood, like every area of town has one neighborhood where literally 10,000 kids go.
Yeah.
But our neighborhood used to have a hayride and we would like dress the kids up and go up and down because I live kind of in the hills.
Yeah.
But more and more kids just want to go to these big locations. They don't want to walk down the scary little driveway.
Damn. That's so boring.
I know. Yes,
that was such a thrill.
I'm just going to run up and down the street and tell all the kids to come outside. Come outside, trick or treat.
I'll be happy if I get like two trick or treaters this year.
I always tell these guys in New Zealand it wasn't a big thing, trick or treating. And we actually, with Freddie and Jason, we're kids. We go up to the door and the person's like, oh, I don't know if I have anything. Just come inside and we'll find it. We walk inside, go down two flights of stairs, in someone's house as they open their fridge and give us juice. And then that was normal in New Zealand. Like it wasn't weird that you're in a stranger's house.
Not a side of lamb or something.
No, you would think, right? Okay, anyway, very strange.
And on that note, see ya.
See ya.
Thank you.